Come on, everybody. It's Ed Till.
It is the Ed Till Show. What a great guest we have to kick things off. The Monday after the Oscars totally embarrassed themselves. You know what I like the most is last night. It's the first time I don't remember, honestly, probably could have happened a couple of more times. I've never seen Warren Beatty so thrown. And he's like such an ego, maniacal, overrated, whatever. I mean, I like a couple of his movies, but he's, you know, he's just an actor. But for years and years, he was trying, to, I think, to fulfill the Jack Nicholson role. Jack used to be great at the Oscars. He was, of course, got his Oscar many, many years ago. I believe it was for The Shining. He gave a great acceptance speech that they recapped last night. But I do have to say, the august nature and feel of the Oscars was not there last night. All right, let's welcome someone who knows lots about Academy Awards nights, Marie Lene Rogus. Hey, Marie, welcome to the Ed Till Show on Starcom Radio Network.
Ed, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, boy, I tell you, I enjoyed Warren Beatty looking foolish last night because all he had to do was not show it to the empty-headed Faye Dunaway, there wouldn't have been a mistake. An intelligent person would have just held it and said, I think they gave me the wrong envelope. But,
I felt that way, too. He looked so perplexed there for a minute. I thought, whoa, is he, you know, getting a little old there?
Right.
And then I realized later that he just didn't know what to say.
Isn't that something? I thought was the most incredible moment. Warren Beatty, Mr. Cool, right, screwed on the simplest, like it's like getting the wrong shopping list. The minute you get it, you know it's wrong. But this is what I think, you know, made us all feel good. Powerless, wordless, completely inept, had no way to go, and he waddled out there. That was the thing where Jimmy Kimmel was like, you know, trying to boost him up a little bit and go, yeah, don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. And the truth is, Warren Beatty was melting down on camera. It was amazing. Yeah.
He must be so mad today.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, he is, you know, you said it. Let's give him credit. He's up there. He's got to be 85 or something nearby, right?
I'm not sure how old, but yeah.
Right, up there. I mean,
he probably wanted to look good, you know, and really present himself well.
Exactly.
It was a shame, actually. And
well, you know what? It was history. That's what was exciting last night. I'm sitting there, one eye open. I'm like, oh, my God, there was a reason to watch till the end. So, anyway, has Oscar night always been a big thing for you? When I was a kid, I think I started watching the Oscars when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and my parents made a big deal out of watching it in the living room, and everything had to be done, the chores, dinner, everything had to be put away so we could all watch the Oscars. Were you raised in the same reverence for the Oscar?
I actually was, and sometimes there were like parties, and it was always a special night for us, and I've always looked forward to it. Past couple of years, not so much. I've been pretty busy, but and I'm not always sure of all of the newer stars that are around right now.
Right.
I can't keep track of everybody.
Right.
But last night was really, I think it was an interesting show. Some of it was sort of predictable, but it certainly was memorable.
Right. Didn't you love bringing in the crowd on the bus and letting the little...
And the little candies falling down? I thought that was really cool.
I loved it.
I liked that.
It let the people who buy the overpriced tickets and feel disappointed on those Saturday nights actually see these people so that they made them real. I like that. I like that they were real last night. They couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very exciting. Jimmy Kimmel, how do you think he did?
Didn't you feel like the stars were actually happy to meet these people, too? I mean, they gave that impression.
You know, I got the impression they all wanted hand sanitizer because they just don't go out they don't meet the peasants. We don't shake hands with the peasants. They're not moisturized. They're not fake tanned.
So, well, they put on a good show, I'll tell you that.
They
did. That's why they're actors.
They did. You know, before we even get to Kimmel, I'm going to ask you what you think about him. They got to fire somebody at Pricewaterhouse, don't they? Somebody's got to bite it for last night. Somebody.
I thought about that. I thought about that this morning, too. How could they make an error like that? I mean, that was such a bad one. How could there be two that said Emma Stone?
Well, here's what I learned, right? The two accountants show up to the building, and they each have a complete set of winners. It was a gal and a guy last night who were in charge. And they haven't said how, but somehow, right, instead of handing the Emma Stone envelope to the correct presenter, it hung out in that briefcase. In other words, it'd be just like if you were giving out things in order, then somebody didn't pick up their stuff. Now it's sitting right there. So this is how the Emma Stone card got out there. But she was pretty fast in saying, I have my own card here, so I can account for one of them correctly. Oh, yeah, it was crazy, but I loved it. It made it exciting last night.
It really did. I once was able to hold one of those Oscars in my hand right after John Voight won his award for Coming Home.
Wow. I remember him winning
heavy.
That year. Yeah.
They're heavy little suckers.
Right.
And then they have to have their they have to leave to be engraved. They're not engraved when they are given.
Oh, you get a blank and then you I thought they gave you something to hold for the evening. While they actually made your real one. Is that not the case, where they give you a dummy for the evening for photos?
That might be true. I'm not sure about that, because I know that I don't know. The one I held was pretty heavy. Mm. And he was, they were going to send it out to get it engraved. But you could almost feel the energy on it. It was a strange moment, because it was the day after that I held it. And it must weigh 5 pounds.
Wow.
It was heavy. I mean, I'm probably exaggerating. But
yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah. Have you been to the Oscars? Have you sat in that building when it's going on, either at the
pit?
Oh,
no. No, not me.
I mean, I've walked by it many times in Hollywood, right? You're on top of the hill there, Capitol Records building, and you look over, you see the Pantages, and you think, oh, boy, that sidewalk has had so many people, you know, either walk on it or collapse on it or party on it. Pretty phenomenal. How did you come to know some of the great stars that you have stories about? Cary Grant, Mae West, Raquel Welch. I mean, I love those folks. That, to me, is real Hollywood. Cary Grant was a god in my household.
Yeah.
He was the standard of being a gentleman. Sure. Tell me what you know. How did you come to have stories about Cary?
I worked at Universal Studios. I was only 19. I got the job sort of out of luck. Somebody, I was working for the Air Force, and someone said, who is a camera person? And he said, what are you doing here in the Air Force when you could be doing something more fun, like working in the motion picture industry? And I said, oh, well, yeah, right, sure.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'll set you up. I know somebody. And I'm going, oh, yeah, this is just a come on. Right.
Not
for a second did I buy that. And then he saw me like a week later, and he says, okay, you've got an interview with the head of the steno department. And so I went, okay. And I went over there, and she hired me on the spot.
Oh, my God.
And that happened to, I know, it was pretty weird. And that happened to be the time before the big black glass tower building that's on Universal. So all of the stars and producers and directors all had individual little bungalows all over the lot, you know. And there were little sidewalks that would separate one group of bungalows from the other. And I was working for a producer and writer who did the early Rock Hudson movie Gathering of Eagles. And right next door to my bungalow, or our bungalow, was Bob Author and Cary Grant. So I'd have to take that little walkway to go to my car, to go to the main walkway to go to my car. And, you know, I'd see him every now and then on the grass talking to Bob Author or somebody. And one day he just came bounding over to me, and he said, I hey, you're rather shy, aren't you? And I was. You know?
That's awesome. And, you're being hit on at this moment by Cary Grant. That is amazing. Go on. What else happened? What did he say?
Well, as we would talk, you know, we would talk from time to time, and then one night, as I was walking on that sidewalk, he came over again, and we were chatting, and he says, would you like to have dinner with me? So I said,
wow.
Sure.
Wow. Wow.
So he said, would you like to have dinner with me at my home? And I went, okay. Wow. And he said, you can follow me in your car, because he lived up off of Coldwater Canyon, but up high in one of the hills. So I followed him, and then I got out of my car and went into his beautiful Rolls Royce. It's the first time, of course, I'd ever been in a Rolls Royce. Patted that soft gray calfskin seat, and thought, what the heck am I doing? And so he took me up to his house. It was evening, and yet the lights were all twinkling, and he took me into his home. He introduced me to his housekeeper, cook. Mm. And I noticed that half of his furniture was covered in sheets, because he spent half a year in England and half a year in Beverly Hills, and he was getting ready to leave to go back to England, so they were preserving the house. So he took me back into his bedroom, because he entertains.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was offered champagne cocktails and caviar on toast, neither of which I'd ever had before, but enjoyed them.
Mmm, I'll bet. So, does he sound like Cary Grant when you're hanging out with him? Or is it, you know, the caricature of how smooth and funny?
He did sound like Cary Grant. And, you know, I have to say, he was probably one of the most graceful men walking I have ever seen in my life. He looked like he was walking on air. Wow. You'd think he was a ballet dancer the way he walked.
Wow.
He just held his body so tight up that when he walked, he just was so amazingly graceful. And you see that in his films, you know, but seeing it in person, but sitting next to him in person, and I'm looking at him, and he's really very nice. You know?
Wow.
I'm thinking, my God, I'm sitting here next
pinching
to the
yourself,
biggest
right?
Hollywood
right.
star in the world.
Oh,
it was very surreal. Very, very surreal wow. moment.
Now, what part of town did he live in? Is he from the Mulholland Drive where the Brandos and the others live up there?
No, he wasn't. He was in a section that overlooked Beverly Hills.
Mm.
I don't know if you're familiar, but Coldwater Canyon goes from the San Fernando Valley to Beverly Hills.
Right.
So you have to take this canyon, and there's little streets that go up the hill to these certain areas. So he his home was on a hill overlooking all of Beverly Hills.
Mm, how nice. Now, what year was this? What era are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about early 1960s. I'm sorry. That's a
best.
Long time ago.
Yeah, but those were the days.
I was young.
That's when stars were stars. So,
they were.
They were. Cary Grant, a pinnacle.
I would see Cary Grant and Rox Hudson walking together to the commissary, or that Tony Curtis was really big then. Doris Day was doing a movie with Cary Grant at the time, Touch of Mink, which I don't know if you've
Oh, sure, that. Yeah. Yeah, no, I've seen all these films. So everything you've mentioned, I love.
Yeah, and I think that was her last film. I think she retired after that. She said she was 40 and she didn't want to, you know, continue or something. I don't know.
Wow.
But it was really a special time. The whole feeling is different than it is now.
So let me ask this.
Now there's so many independent producers, you know.
Sure. Let me ask, you know, George Clooney is well known for being a practical joker, where on the first day of shooting, you know, he'll lock the men's room, people can't use it, all this kind of, you know, prankster stuff. And I thought that was great when I found it. I said, well, you know something, that must make it more fun to work on a movie with him. Are you aware of any pranking that went on back in the day? Were any of the folks that you ran into kind of cut-ups? Because Cary Grant had a little bit of that, I think.
Well, I wasn't on a upset with him. I'm sure he probably did. He was, he had a twinkle in his eye. He would do some pretty unexpected things. However,
now, how'd you meet?
I work for are so professional.
Right.
And, you know, they would call it magic time, especially the first day of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the energy would go up high, and everybody would put on different hats. Even the producer would put on his producer hat, and the director would put on their... They just had a different aliveness to them. It's time, you know.
Right.
And that energy... But I'm sure there can be a lot of fun, you know, but the crew is so professional, and I have so much respect for them. I'm sure you have that as well.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Without the crew, you have nothing.
That's right.
So, but I didn't see any, I've seen people blow their lines, you know, and do bloopers and things,
right.
But not on purpose.
Okay. Now, how did you come across Mae West? Because she was up there in the 60s, right? She was kind of an elderly...
Well, I met her when she was 76.
Wow!
She was doing... I was working for the director of the first transgender movie, Myra Breckinridge.
I remember the film. Rex Reed, right? Wrote that?
Yeah, Rex Reed. And beautiful Raquel Welch played Myra.
Right.
Myron.
And the book
amazing.
Was Gore Vidal, wasn't the book? Came from the book by Gore Vidal, I think. Right, Raquel Welch. Oh, absolutely. I remember it like it was, we were in the movie theater. We were just old enough to be able to see it. That's how we got into Myra Breckinridge.
That movie left you with a big question mark in your mind. I'm sure, like, what the heck did I see?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of everybody's feeling was. But it was Michael was extravagant and fantastical, and that's kind of where he went with that. But Mae West was in that film, and she had a special clause that she could write her own dialogue. And Michael also wrote the screenplay, so he always got the last word, but Mae could write her own dialogue because she's the only one who can write like Mae West can.
Right. Yeah.
That special part of her. So she asked me if I would take dictation for her scenes, which I did, and that's when I met her. And she was, you know, she was dressed in white satin trousers and a top, and she spoke like Mae, and she and she referred to herself in the third person all the time. Well, Mae would do it this way, and it was just very memorable. And
awesome.
Of course her lines were too.
Oh yeah. Now, she didn't say "follow me in your car, we'll go back to my place and have dinner." That would have been a double.
No,
that would have been wild, right? Having Cosmos with Mae West going nuts. All right, so more modern is you bumped into De Niro. You have a story about Robert De Niro.
I worked for Chardoff Winkler Productions, and they were doing Raging Bull. They'd already done New York too, so they were familiar with working with Scorsese and De Niro. And I was production coordinator on that film, as well as doing some of the post-production.
Okay, what does production coordinator do? What's that actual job? You have the checklist of everything that's supposed to be there on set?
Correct. Everything that's on set went through my...
Is that
everything that happens.
Is that the same as continuity?
No, it's
different.
Really the production manager's right hand. So everything from time cards to the light bulb goes off in the makeup mirror. You know, everything that needs to be done, every report to SAG, everything has to go through that desk. So I had a lot of responsibility. I wasn't on the set that often. I didn't have a lot of personal interaction with De Niro. Some, because he would come into the office now and then and talk to my boss, and he was very pleasant. But when my husband died, he was very generously donated to the Kidney Foundation in his honor. So, you know, that's my story.
That's a nice side of him, huh? What was his demeanor like? You said he was very polite and stuff, but could you feel the New York on him? I mean, he's very New York, Greenwich Village grown up, and his artistry from his father, etc. Could you feel that, or did he really blend in where he just looked like anybody else, except he happened to be Robert De Niro?
Well, Well, my first husband, Jack, was from Brooklyn, so, you know, I kind of was familiar with that sense, that sense of who
did he have it?
Was.
Did De Niro have that?
Mm. No, De Niro did not really come off that way. He came off very, as a matter of fact, and not a lot of people knew him really well even then. You know, he had just done Taxi Driver, and then he did New York, New York. And he was just very pleasant, very, very normal, very pleasant, very unassuming when I interacted with
right.
him.
Now, let me ask you, when you saw a couple of months ago that De Niro didn't like Trump, and then he said he wanted to punch Trump in the face, did that connect? Did you make say, well, yeah, that's the Bobby De Niro that was walking around back then. That sounds like him, or does that sound out of character? That
he, no, I think a lot of people probably feel that way. So I think
right.
No, I think that's in character. For
right,
him.
Right.
I think De Niro says what he feels.
Yeah, and I think he's the kind of guy who would enjoy punching someone. I mean, he certainly did it as an actor enough, but I thought that was very interesting recently. I mean, he also got very wrapped up in this election. They kept, you know, spouting about it, which is not always what's good for your career. But honestly, at this point in his career, he's done everything. Why not speak out, right?
Right. I think he's just being who he is. I think he's being authentic with his feelings.
Right. All right. So now you're going to tell us a story about Sylvester Stallone. He's all of the actors that had a huge impression on me. So when did you bump into Stallone in your work?
I first met him again at Chertoff Winkler. He had his office was next to mine. So he came in with his entourage into the office, my office actually, and asked me what I thought of Rocky. That's all. And I told him I thought it was great, you know. And he was pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started doing Rocky II. I was I did all the post production on Rocky II. Even my daughter, I even got my daughter to sing in that Gonna Fly Now song where you hear all of the kids singing.
Yeah, you got your daughter in there.
Yeah.
How sweet.
Yeah. Why
now,
not? She was little.
Now, right, absolutely. Post-production is a lot more than just editing the film, right? Editing is post-production, but what else that we wouldn't think of is actually post-production?
Doing the screen credits, getting music clearance, arranging for dubbing and looping. If an actor is somewhere else after the show, you have to fly them to where the session is and fly them back, put them up, get them a limo, all that.
Wow, how much fun did you have doing all this? Every day must have been like exciting, thrilling, and you had to say, and this is my job. It's not just thrilling and exciting, it's my job.
It was very, very busy. You know, there was a lot to do, and it, like anybody in the crew, that's their job. That's what they do. They do it to their best. So that's, I never questioned anything. That particular job has an overwhelming amount of work to do, both production coordinator and doing the post production. Because nothing can fall through. I mean, you have to arrange for a hall for all of the musicians. You have to hire a coordinator to hire the musicians. Everything has to be, they don't happen magically. Everything has to be set up and coordinated.
Right. So are you still living in the Hollywood area? Where are you these days?
No, my husband and I left Lorimore Productions. I was a paralegal at the time I left, and I started a business with my husband. We started with a couple of products in the garage and went on after 13 years to have about 52 products. So
wow.
I kind of changed my emphasis on what I was doing. And then when we moved to San Diego and we sold the business, I didn't want to move back to L.A. And I still miss the industry. I still miss working for it. I loved it.
Oh, yeah.
18 years of it, it was in my soul, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it was.
It's the same way about radio.
Well, it's the adrenaline kick. Every day, you don't know when, you don't know where, you don't know how. There's going to be something amazing. And I'm sure so many people envy that kind of job you had. You were right in the middle of everything, integral to everything. So exciting. I do want to get a nice plug-in for your book. It's called Grief Comfort Guide, A Personal Journey from Loss to Light. What made you write the book?
two things. First of all, I lost seven loved ones, seven of my family members. And I had started toying with the idea of writing, but like anybody who starts writing who's a nobody, they go, what the heck am I doing here? But I listened to Jack Canfield, the author of Chicken Soup of the Soul, and he said, if you have one thing that you know or do that you think could help someone else, you owe it to them to write the book. And after coping with the losses of seven loved ones, I learned things that I liked, I learned things I didn't like, and I came up with suggestions to help others that might ease their grief a little bit. It's not that you can truly ease it, but there are certain things that you don't know. There's no roadmap to grief, right?
Right.
You get in it, there knows no nationality, has no religion, and you're in it, and you don't know what to do. You don't know the first step to take to make you better, what might bring you comfort. So that's what the book is about. And then I've told the stories of all my family members, and I wanted people to see them the way I did and maybe care a little bit as they learned about them, and then they mattered. They were here and
right.
they existed.
You know, I'm in this generation, and so are my listeners. You know, I've been on the air 40 years, and I've had people listen to me for 35, and we've all entered into this age bracket of caretaking. You know, sometimes you got a big
yeah.
family, sometimes you don't. Are there any insights or tips you'd like to share with people who now are on the threshold of that, and they know they're going to be in it for a while? Would there be anything that might be helpful to them?
I think that when you're dealing with somebody that may have a serious illness or a terminal illness, that's a little bit different, but not too much different than dealing with somebody who, say, has Alzheimer's.
Right.
Because you start grieving the moment you hear that diagnosis.
Right.
So when the culmination of it finally happens and somebody dies, if it takes 5 years, if it takes however long, it's not that the grief won't be as severe, but there's also almost a sense of relief that they're not suffering anymore.
Right.
So it's a little bit different. That kind of grief is a little bit different than like a sudden death, where you're taken off guard and
right.
you're like a deer in the headlights. You have no idea what to do. So I personally believe in it's necessary to find your wailing wall. And what I mean by that is you need to find a place where you can go to over and over again that's as private as you can get it, and yell and scream and sob and you know, get those emotions out of you. It's really important, because holding them in can cause high blood pressure, panic attacks, depression, and, you know, ultimately illness.
That's an excellent suggestion, right? Your own personal wailing wall, we can let it all out, and there's no recrimination. And, you know, it'd be really nice if you had somebody you could share that with, you know. But it's very difficult. I was an only child when I was losing both of my parents to cancer. And I can tell you, it's a very, very dark, dark road to go down there. And having somebody, which eventually I did, but I didn't for most of it, I can tell you from both sides of that, it really is necessary to have a place of safety and a place where your feelings are welcome. I can't tell you how much fun I've had today, Marie. I hope you'll come back on the show.
Oh,
Marie Lene Robus.
I would love it.
Oh, we got so much more.
Thank you so much.
We have so much more to talk about. Yeah. I know your neighborhood. I tell you, I wish I was a fly on the wall. Or I'd actually. What kind of car did Cary Grant drive? You remember?
Beautiful Rolls Royce.
Oh, there you go.
Gray.
That's
silver.
What I'd like to be. I'd like to be a little mosquito inside that Rolls Royce and hear what that guy was doing every day. Unbelievable. Thank you for sharing today. The images and the history mean so much to us. Again, I want to mention the book. This is really a terrific guide for those of you who are now facing grief in your life. Grief Comfort Guide, A Personal Journey from Loss to Light. The website is Grief Comfort Guide. Marie, we're going to talk again soon, okay? Thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Marie Lene Rogus. Awesome stories, man.